Qatar, we are ahead in terms of production. Today, we are producing between 600 and 700 million cubic meters of gas, which is equivalent to 4 million barrels of oil.
The economic benefits of completing Phase 11 of the South Pars gas field are numerous. It is estimated to create up to 10,000 jobs and bring $20 billion of income to Iran. In addition, it will help revive Iran's oil and gas sector, which has been struggling over the years due to sanctions and low investment. Drilling of new wells at Phase 11 is an important step in Iran's drive to achieve energy independence and geopolitical stability, which will dramatically increase the gas production capacity at South Pars. It will meet Iran's domestic consumption needs and help the country emerge as an important regional exporter.
This great achievement by Iran shows that countries under sanction, including Iran, can neutralize unilateral Western sanctions by relying on their domestic capabilities. Farzana Shuryan, Asaluye.
On Friday, a 24-hour national strike was called by a number of base unions representing airline personnel, airport workers, and ground handlers in Italy. As a result of the industrial action, over 100 domestic and international flights were cancelled, with great delays recorded in a number of airports, including those of Milan, Venice, and Verona. It was the 18th strike involving airport and airline personnel in Italy this year. Travelers are feeling that they are left bearing the brunt of the clash between aviation sector companies and their workers.
They are not able to find a mutually satisfying deal. It must be said that workers have been deprived of their social rights over the past years.
I'm from Madrid. I just got here. I don't know if I'll be able to reach my destination today. It's very annoying.
Aviation sector workers have gone berserk as airline fares have skyrocketed over the past year and their salary levels have remained the same, if not worsened.
Union's main demand concerns airport ground service workers' collective agreement covering wages. The latest contract expired 6.5 years ago. In the meantime, inflation has really eaten into wages.
In our airports, we've got insecure, low-paid jobs which push workers into poverty. Some employees are forced to accept part-time jobs for less than 800 euros a month. Some others have to pay for parking their car in the workplace car parking areas, let alone their undignified working conditions. The logic behind this is the same as usual. Services offered at the cheapest rate. We have left the market in the hands of companies, and this is the result.
Goods and services prices in Italy have gone up dramatically since the start of the war in Ukraine. The 2022 annual inflation rate stood at over 8 percentage points, the highest level since 1985. Inflation stands at 6% today. A combination of high cost of living, skyrocketing costs of borrowing money, and insufficient fiscal support has caused a crunch that is felt at nearly every level in the country. Max Cibili, Rome.
There is no end in sight to the suffering of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip amid Tel Aviv's inhumane practices. The Israeli regime has placed a ban on the export of goods from Gaza to the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds since Tuesday, further exacerbating the dire economic situation in the impoverished territory. The Kerem Shalom commercial crossing, located on the southernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, has been partially operating since Israel imposed a tight blockade on Gaza in 2007. Israeli security forces claim to have thwarted an attempt to smuggle explosive materials through the crossing on Monday. Observers say the Israeli claim is possibly an excuse for future military aggression against the Gaza Strip.
The impact of the restrictions and the siege is very harsh and very hard against Palestinian people. I think this comes in order to continue this collective punishment against Palestinians who's living in Gaza and to give Israeli government a justification for any military action.
The Israeli decision to ban exports from Gaza has inflicted heavy losses on the private sector and its various segments. It has deprived businessmen and manufacturers of the ability to market their products, disrupting production and employment.
Stopping exports from the Kerem Shalom crossing has had a grave impact on many factories in Gaza, including my factory. Currently, I'm working with only one-third of my employees because I can't afford to pay salaries. If this catastrophic situation continues, I will lose my business and all my employees will be out of work.
In addition to the ban on exports, the Israeli regime limits the quantity of the goods allowed into the impoverished territory and bans the entry of most raw materials for factories. The Palestinian NGOs Network, which represents over 140 Palestinian civil society organizations, says Tel Aviv's move to ban exports will further complicate living conditions in Gaza. According to officials in Gaza, businesses are losing $500,000 daily because of the export ban. Experts say the Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip since 2007 has wreaked havoc on the economy of Gaza and has had grave humanitarian consequences. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Twenty-three-year-old Wazir Azrar arrives at the Federal Agency for Asylum Seekers in Brussels, having been in Belgium for 6 months. Wazir says Western powers destroyed his country, Afghanistan, and now help is not available. Officials at the agency rejected his documents.
I have been waiting for that for 6 months. I've been sleeping on the street, also like in the park. Yeah, this is a big problem here in Belgium for the Afghan refugees and also for the Syrian refugees, you know.
A coach full of families then arrives, and those people are granted access to the asylum application centre. This is because the Belgian government, led by Alexander De Croo, says male refugees travelling alone are no longer welcome in the country.
They're thinking we are just animals in refugees. They don't respect us. That's why I came here. For example, we need like doctors, like these very important things, but they don't care also.
Hundreds of men, mainly from Africa and the Middle East, are sleeping on the streets of Belgium. At the same time, the country is providing full protection to 62,000 Ukrainian refugees. They enjoy the same rights as EU citizens. The European Commission says it is aware of reports that Belgium is rejecting asylum applications from non-Ukrainian single men.
We understand that these are announcements at this stage, so this is still being discussed by the Belgian government, so we will need to see what is exactly happening, and the Commission will be contacting also the Belgian authorities in this respect.
De Croo's administration insists families, women and children must be prioritised as winter approaches. Groups such as Amnesty International claim the Belgian government has reached a new low. They are demanding that authorities here start respecting EU asylum laws and international asylum laws. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Erdogan arrived in Sochi on the eve of the G20 summit. This was his first visit to Russia since his re-election in May. The Turkish official began the meeting with his Russian counterpart by expressing gratitude for Moscow's assistance in extinguishing forest fires and also efforts in eliminating the consequences of a powerful February earthquake. The two sides continued with the topic of the gas hub, which is also their common project. But it was clear that the topic of Ukraine and the grain deal were the main items on the agenda of Recep Tayyip Erdogan in the trip.
We are determined to continue efforts to establish lasting peace, stability and prosperity in our region. We previously hosted the direct negotiations between the conflicting parties. As before, we are ready to do our best and act as a mediator.
Erdogan arrived on the eve of the G20 summit in New Delhi. Therefore, the issue of the grain deal was also raised, from which Russia withdrew, since not a single promise given by the Western partners was fulfilled. Putin noted that the withdrawal of Russia does not affect the food crisis. In addition, Russia is ready to come up with several initiatives at once.
We intend to organize the supply of 1 million tons of grain from Russia at a preferential price for processing to Turkey and then free transportation to the poor countries. In this sense, we count on the help from the Qatari state, who is ready to support the poorest countries for humanitarian reasons.
According to the Russian leader, the initiative is not a replacement for the grain deal, but would make a great contribution to solving the food problem in the African countries. The visit by the Turkish president turned out to be quite short, just a few hours, and no documents were signed.
Turkey's hopes to extend the grain deal did not come true. However, Moscow and Ankara are already engaged in several joint projects. Russia is building the Akuyu nuclear power plant, and the state of the gas hub, which diversifies Russian gas supplies to Europe, also depends on Moscow. Russia is actively supporting Turkey in various sectors of the national economy, ranging from banking to metallurgy. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Pilgrims visiting the holy shrines of Kadimayn on their way back home. The complex located in Kadimiya near the capital Baghdad is the resting place of the 7th and the 9th Shia imams, as well as the tomb of a prominent Shia theologian and jurist, Sheikh al-Mufid, who made key contributions to Shia jurisprudence and helped shape what today is referred to as the doctrine of Mahdaviyat, the belief in the reappearance of the 12th Shia Imam, Imam Mahdi, as the savior of mankind at the end of times.
Imam Mahdi had to go into a state of occultation because of the threats to his life after his father died, during a period of about 70 years, which is called the Minor Occultation. Four successive deputies represented him, and he is believed to have communicated regularly with his followers through these deputies. We are now at the resting place of the third deputy. The second deputy's resting place is just a few streets away.
According to Muslim beliefs, with the death of the fourth deputy, the major occultation began, and it will continue until God grants Imam Mahdi permission to reappear and bring peace and justice to all. During this period, Muslims are expected to pray for his reappearance and take action to facilitate that. This provides the basis for a very different philosophy and perspective than what the international public opinion is pushed to accept. Being totally different from materialistic and atheist schools of thought, Mahdaviyat can positively impact how people interact with each other in different levels, from ordinary people to high-ranking government officials.
Imam Mahdi is believed to return at the end of time to rid the world of all evil and to spread justice. The doctrine based on this belief is called the Mahdaviyat doctrine, which in today's world can create a major shift in political and economic equations. Gisumish Ahmadi, Kadimiya.
Tensions remain high in Sweden after the Holy Quran was desecrated in the city of Malmo on Sunday. A notorious Iraqi hate preacher has been attacking Islam's holy text on a routine basis for weeks. His antics led to an angry response as 15 people were arrested following confrontations with the police. Police provided protection for the offensive action and even arrested some Muslims who tried to save the Quran from the flames. Cities up and down Sweden are all being affected by these anti-Islam incidents. This mosque in central Stockholm has routinely been the victim of Quran desecration antics, many of which have been taking place right outside their front doorsteps and with police protection at that. The Muslim world has responded angrily, trying to pressure the Swedish authorities to curb this rising trend in Islamophobic stunts. A local Swedish Muslim activist explained how the government's defense of hate speech is costing Sweden dearly.
Almost majority of Swedish people, they don't like these actions, you know, because this will destroy Swedish reputation in the world. And this kind of acts may hurt millions of Muslims all over the world. So to let this thing just happen in this country. We almost see that the Finland, like for example, and even Denmark right now, they are studying the things that they will prohibit the burning of Quran. So why cannot Sweden do that?
Though acknowledging that these acts hurt Sweden's image and put its security at risk, the authorities here have shown no concrete signs of changing the laws to protect Muslims from hate preachers. Swedish security services have also admitted the country's security situation has deteriorated following the Quran burnings. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
In the limelight. An overwhelming majority of Britons say the cost of living crisis is the biggest issue facing the country at the moment, placing further question marks over Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's chances at the next general election, given his difficulties gaining control over the issue. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mirror has covered this story and tells us more. Research revealed on Thursday, 3rd of August, that 6 million workers are grappling with the cost of living crisis while toiling in insecure jobs. Analysts said grafters on zero-hours contracts, the low-paid self-employed, employees getting less than 16 hours a week, and people in casual, seasonal or fixed-term and agency roles were worse placed as they battled through the hardship. A survey study for the Living Wage Foundation found that 19% of British workers are in insecure jobs, while 10% are in insecure jobs that also pay below the real living wage. The figures represent 6.1 million and 3.4 million people respectively. Survation is a polling and market research agency based in London. Some 59% of all shift workers have received less than a week's notice of working hours, with 13% being given less than 24 hours' notice. Critics say it makes life difficult for people to arrange other employment and plan paying bills, and with some even driven to food banks. A quarter of shift workers have had stints cancelled unexpectedly by their boss, with 90% not given their full rate of pay and 22% plunging deeper into debt or turning to credit cards. The foundation said workers who are most affected by insecurity are those least well-placed to manage its financial burdens. It highlighted cleaners, delivery drivers and some National Health Service staff as being up to five times more likely to be in insecure jobs than those earning at or above the real living wage. The minimum hourly legal rate for staff aged over 23 years old is £10.42 an hour, while the voluntary real living wage is £10.90 an hour for workers of all ages, rising to £11.95 an hour in London. The Living Wage Foundation urged British firms to sign up to its latest scheme, Living Hours. Under the project, employers pledge to provide at least 4 weeks' notice for every shift, with guaranteed payment if shifts are cancelled within that notice period. Companies also offer a guaranteed minimum of 16 working hours a week, unless the worker requests fewer and a contract reflecting hours worked. The foundation's director, Catherine Chapman, said soaring prices have rightly shone a spotlight on pay this past year, But this research makes clear that reliable working hours are as vital as workers' financial resilience as a real living wage. It is shocking that 3.4 million workers are facing the cost of living crisis in low-paying jobs with unstable working hours, making planning a life on a budget impossible. Catherine Chapman added, "While the rate of inflation has begun to fall, households across the country don't need economists to tell them that prices remain exorbitantly high. That is why we're calling on employers to join those who have already stepped up during this crisis and commit to provide workers with living hours, secure guaranteed hours and notice of shift patterns alongside a real living wage." Joseph Rowntree's Foundation's senior policy advisor, Louise Woodruff, said, "Reliable hours and a real living wage are the foundations of good employment, making it truly shocking that this report reveals millions of people are navigating the cost of living crisis in low-paid, insecure jobs. It's clear we cannot beat in-work poverty without profound changes in Britain's labour market. The Living Wage Foundation's Living Hours Scheme provides employers with a framework to lead us towards a future of stable employment and decent pay, of dignity for Servation polled 2,023 people online in April. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Against the backdrop of coronavirus pandemic and soaring inflation, British businesses have defied the odds and signed up to join the living wage movement in record numbers over the past 2 years. There are now 13,000 living wage employers across the United Kingdom signed up to pay the independently calculated real living wage to all directly employed and subcontracted staff. Insecure work, especially when coupled with low pay, remains a vicious combination trapping millions of people in in-work poverty. New research from the Living Wage Foundation released on Thursday, 3rd of August, reveals that a staggering 6 million British jobs are insecure, including over a million people on zero-hour contracts. As well as making it hard to budget and plan, insecure employment costs workers. This insecurity premium can add up to £600 per year because of last-minute shift cancellations or being called into work at short notice. For example, 27% of insecure workers had to spend more on travel, 17% have had to pay higher childcare costs, and around 24% have had shifts cancelled unexpectedly, with 25% then not paid at all. With pay packets already eroded by high inflation, these additional costs place yet another pressure on those at the sharpest end of the cost of living crisis. Economists say job security is a critical next piece of the picture if British officials are to eradicate in-work poverty in the United Kingdom. The website of iNews has also covered the same story and tells us more. Polling showed the majority of British people say they are struggling or just about managing in the face of the worst cost of living crisis in a generation. An exclusive survey by BMG Consulting on behalf of iNews reveals that nearly 6 in 10 voters, or 58%, say they are just staying afloat due to the historic squeeze on household budgets. The figures come just days before the Bank of England will decide on whether to raise interest rates for the 14th consecutive time, with speculation mounting that the bank could increase interest rates by 0.25 percentage point to 5.25%. Pressure is on the bank to raise interest rates for both the US Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, the ECB, increased base rates by 0.25 percentage point recently. It comes amid growing fears that another rate rise risks tipping the economy into an unnecessary recession, with households already battling to keep their finances in check. Polling for iNews shows that Britons are far more likely to say they're struggling or just about managing in the current climate. Perhaps of greater concern for the government, more than half or 52% of the more than 1,500 people surveyed say they were worried about paying for everyday essentials such as food, petrol and bills each month. Of that, nearly one in five or 18% said they were very worried. An overwhelming majority of respondents, 80%, said the cost of living crisis was the biggest issue facing the country at the moment, placing a further question mark over Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's chances at the next election, given his difficulties gaining control over the issue. Inflation has remained stubbornly high throughout 2023, with the latest figures showing prices rising by 7.9%. The slowing in inflation has left the Prime Minister facing an uphill battle to bring it down to half the 10.1% he committed to in January. But the headline inflation rate only shows part of the picture, with the cost of food in the United Kingdom higher than it has been for more than 40 years.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
G20 leaders meeting in India should have displayed a show of unity amongst the 20 most advanced economies in the world to find solutions to the world's most pressing problems. But it has failed to do so, even though it is putting on a show of unity. First, there was the absence of China, which chose not to attend this meeting, and then there's Russia, who could not attend due to the Ukraine conflict, or decided to even skip it, were it Russian president to be invited. And in terms of consensus, there was lack of one on many fronts, like phasing out of fossil fuels, and the Ukraine war. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the relevance of G20 and the rise of other blocs like the BRICS. First, let me introduce our guests. Okay, let's go right to our guests. We have Harley Schlanger, spokesman of the International Schiller Institute at Potsdam, Germany. We also have Glenn Deason, professor of political science at the University of Southeastern Norway. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Looking at this G20 summit, I'd like to start off with you, Harley Schlanger, regarding the communique that was announced. And figure out from you what it means. First of all, let's see. The philosophy that they want to promote is that they're dealing with things like rising commodity prices, food and energy prices are contributing to the cost of living pressures, global challenges, poverty and inequality. There's about, I think, 80 to 100 paragraphs that they all seem to have a consensus on. And they're touting and really are proud of that. What do you think of the G20? I mean, do they have relevance when they haven't been able to achieve their previous goals, and they keep repeating some of the ones from the previous summits into this one?
Well, I think the point is you have to look behind the G20 to see what the fight is. The
G20 has the G7 nations, and then it has a number of nations that are orienting toward the BRICS and a new financial structure. And the problem there is that the G7 thought they could strong-arm India into breaking with Russia, create more provocations between India and China, try to use the summit to adopt Western talking points, the unipolar order, continue the war against Ukraine, denounce Russia, denounce China, and so on. But we saw this fall flat earlier in the week at the ASEAN summit, where Kamala Harris, the U.S. vice president, was sent there to, well, the president of Indonesia was talking about cooperation, coordination, and no provocations. Kamala Harris went in and said, we've got to organize to stop China. We've got to support Ukraine. And she was roundly denounced by many of the leaders of the developing sector. So then you project that a couple of days later at the G20. And the idea that somehow you can get India, China, Russia, even though the Xi Jinping wasn't there, the Chinese had a delegation at the G20. But they're going in different directions. The G7 want confrontation. They want to weaken the move against the dollar order. And instead, the developing sector countries are saying, we want to be heard. We want to play a part in this. So they can agree on all sorts of surface issues. But underneath, there's an absolute diametric opposition.
The next question I want to ask you, Glenn Deason, is really not with a sense of humor that I'm asking this question. But I'm wondering whether there should be a G20 or a G7 in terms of a category, when, as our guests there talked about how the G20, we have to look behind that, and then you have the G7, and then, of course, we have the BRICS grouping of nation. There just seems to be too many countries within the first 20 or 30 economies of the world that are being placed into categories. Which categories do you think stands united vis-a-vis the other ones?
Well, I think that, of course, these talks are a good idea because there has to be some diplomacy and discussions in order to bridge differences. But also, it's an interesting time we live in because we are transitioning now from unipolarity to multipolarity. And, of course, there's great divisions. The G7 are quite united in the goal of preserving unipolarity, that is the collective hegemony of the West under U.S. leadership. Meanwhile, you see the rest of the G20, the non-Western states, there is more of a push towards multipolarity, which is then expressed in BRICS, SCO, and similar organizations. So that doesn't mean that the entire global South is united on all issues, but on the topic of multipolarity, and not wanting to live in this unipolar world, I think that this is a very strong consensus. So I think around this you see clear divisions, but this multipolar world can either be born through diplomacy or in blood and iron. So I think as the West now, we are looking to confront Russia, escalate further. We want to confront the Chinese by slowing down their economic growth, possibly going to war over Taiwan. I think it's a good idea to speak, but obviously to talk, at least for mutual understanding. And otherwise, I would just say that I agree that not much could be done. However, what is also interesting is that the West could not dictate the G20 yeah. common statement. And that's a very good indicator that multipolarity is already here. They could not strong-arm the Indians. They could not strong-arm the rest of the world. And if you go and look at the explicit text from the statement, it's quite clear that the Western powers did not get their way and they had to compromise.
So we got to look at how Western media is trying to make things appear otherwise. Because when you read the publications online, it's not really pointing towards that. But I'm curious, Harley Schlanger, why they didn't come out and slam Russia when it came to the Ukraine war. Why was there a softening, as they described it, of the language that had to deal with Russia and its role in the Ukraine conflict compared to at least last year? Why do you think that was?
Well, diplomacy and dialogue are essential, as the other guests said. But the Western countries aren't really interested in dialogue. They're interested in continuing to assert their policies. Now, on the Russia question, the language may be softened a little, but look at what they're doing. The United States just voted another $300 million of weapons. Germany has been pulled completely.
Sorry, is that after the $1
billion? Oh, yeah. This is on Friday, it was announced by Biden. So you have, and they're also sending depleted uranium shells now to Ukraine from the United States. So any softening of the language was meant to avoid a blow up. But the Western media still hasn't gotten the message that the Global South is basically saying, we want our voices to be heard. What Modi, the Indian Prime Minister, said is that he would use his chairmanship of the G20 to ensure that the Global South has a say in policies. And so rather than just steamrolling it and shutting down any discussion, there's an aura of cooperation. But the reality is that the West, as the other guest said, is committed to destroying Russia using Ukraine as a proxy war and confronting China and trying to break apart the unity that was established at the South Africa summit of the BRICS 10 days ago. So, you know, the Western media is not going to acknowledge that there's this kind of opposition. They're still saying that Russia is isolated. That's what the U.S. press is saying, that the rest of the world doesn't support Russia. Well, it's not a question of supporting Russia. The rest of the world is saying there must be negotiations, which the Biden administration and NATO have ruled out. So that's why they can't get a consensus agreement on the Ukraine war.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Deason, what about China, the fact that you have Xi Jinping skipping this event? I mean, yes, they do have a delegation there, but at the same time, does that show that Xi Jinping perhaps doesn't, G20 doesn't have that much of a relevance for maybe China the way that it would in the past, especially when it comes to China's priorities? Is that maybe one way of looking at it or not?
Well, the Chinese have their own concerns. They're not too eager to engage in any diplomacy with the United States anymore because they don't like the way the Americans do their diplomacy, putting sanctions on their top officials and doing this maximum pressure against China and then using diplomacy as a way of setting conditions for removing some of these sanctions. So they pretty much made it clear that they don't have really anything to say to the Americans before they drop these instruments of coercion and begin to speak, again, using diplomacy. So, but also the Chinese, obviously, they have some of these tensions with India. So I wouldn't write off the G20 immediately, but obviously Xi Jinping not showing up is quite noteworthy. Most didn't expect Putin to come, given that they're in the middle of a war. But otherwise, yeah, I would just like to say I agree with the other argument here. That is, I think that the Western media is largely now involved in managing perceptions, which is why, you know, if you tell the Western public, listen, Russia's isolated, the world is against them, then this is what is needed for the public to continue supporting the war. And of course, it also has some effect in terms of public diplomacy in the global south, trying to portray to the global south, the public there, that the Russians are isolated. So it's said, you know, you fake it until you make it. This also applies in politics. You manage perceptions until it becomes reality that Russia would be isolated. But, of course, it is very disingenuous. And again, I would advise to look at the actual statements which came out of the G20. I did not see this isolation of Russia.
Well, it's quite a bit. I think it's about 80 to 120 paragraphs. I mean, Harley Schlanger, we've talked on many times and on many occasions with you also about the fact that there's a new world order. And one of the things that perhaps the U.S. and really just the U.S. who is against this globalization many are still a believer of, like China, like Russia. But since they're not, and since the U.S. that is not a firm believer of that, wants a unipolar world, then doesn't that make the G20 somewhat irrelevant when it comes to like the attendance of the U.S.? What I'm trying to get at is maybe before the G20 might have been relevant, but there's been so many changes in the political landscape that perhaps it doesn't make that much sense to have a G20 grouping in the way that it is, unless there are countries that are playing both sides of the fence. Sorry for putting it that way.
Well, first of all, it's now going to be the G21 since the African Union was brought in.
Right.
Although I don't think they're going to change the name. Look, the basic point is that there are two directions of policy in the world. One is sticking with the unipolar order, where Wall Street, the City of London, the U.S. and NATO dictate economic policy and expect everyone to accept that, including when it impinges on the sovereignty of nations. Then you have this emerging trend of the defense of sovereignty and the government saying that we're going to take care of the interests of our people, and that is economic development, and we won't be suffocated anymore. Now, what's changed in the world is that the Chinese are strong enough as an economy with the Belt and Road Initiative. The Russians are strong enough militarily. The Indians are strong enough. And now we see new players coming into the BRICS, such as Saudi Arabia, Iran, the United Arab Emirates, Argentina, new countries coming in that are supporting the idea of a global South development perspective, with much of the emphasis now on Africa. And the African countries, as we've seen with the coups that have taken place against the pro-French governments in French West Africa, we're seeing that the African countries are asserting their independence in a second wave of decolonization. So I think the question of what kind of institutions there should be, look, the G20 is a good place to fight this out. But the other thing that's going on at this summit is countries that are not part of the G7 are reaching agreements, deals, trade deals, and so on. We saw that at the ASEAN summit, the recent Russian-African summit. There are all kinds of venues. The other guest mentioned the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Eurasian Economic Union. These kinds of things are happening. They're not going to be stopped by the U.S. asserting its right to control the agenda. The only question is, will there be a recognition in the United States that it should not just temper its language, but actually recognize that it's in the interest of the United States to support this development?
Okay. Let's look at some of the things that this communique in their joint statement actually addressed. And I'm going to just talk about categories here. Climate financing, Glenn Deason was one of them, global debt, reform of institutions like the Washington-based World Bank, and of course you have what is mentioned here as a Green Development Pact. Let's take global debt. Let's see where we're standing now. These are issues that have been talked about before in previous G20 summits. If we want to talk about global debt, we're looking at a total global debt that's standing at $305 trillion as of the first quarter of 2023. I mean, what have they done? Aren't they supposed to be dealing with these types of problems? But it doesn't sound like they've really tackled something as big as global debt. Why is that?
I don't have really any good answer to this. It's they are they stated intentions before, but this is something that is, of course, also.
Well, let me do this. I'm sorry. If you don't have an answer for that, then let's move on to like the World Bank, right? They talk about reforms.
Can I say something on the global debt?
Go ahead, Glenn Deason. I'm sorry. We'll have Harley Schlanger talk on that, and then I'll come back to you. I have another one for you. Go ahead, Harley Schlanger.
Okay, well, the U.S. just had the debt ceiling debate, and what they did is they basically kicked the can down the road. The U.S. has about a $35 trillion debt, and that's the government debt. It's got almost as much in terms of corporate debt. Private sector debt is growing. The U.S. is the largest debtor economy in the world. Now, the U.S. can cover it by printing dollars and continue to use unfair trade practices to loot third world countries. That's how the U.S. has been trying to deal with that. But that's not acceptable anymore. Now, if you want to deal with debt, you have to recognize that most of it is unpayable at this moment. And what should be done is that there should be moratoria and cancellation, which, of course, the Western banks won't accept, the IMF won't accept. But the other aspect is invest in new technologies and industrialization so that countries can begin to make.
But the U.S. won't let that happen. It calls it competition from China, but we know how they think about that.
But that's the point. They won't let it happen because it goes against the ability of the West to continue to prop up bankrupt enterprises by stealing from other countries.
Sure.
So that's where the dialogue breaks down. And so you can say anything you want about dealing with debt, but when it comes to actually dealing with it, the U.S. is unwilling to help other countries resolve these problems.
Glenn Deason, what I wanted to get at, basically the thrust of my question was, I just picked global debt, but for example, the World Bank, they keep talking about how the World Bank needs to be reformed. The last time, according to the records, the last time that happened was 25 years ago. They have been talking about reforming the World Bank for so many years, but they haven't done that. There's so many promises made that have not been tackled or resolved or little headway to have been made. Okay, let's maybe, Glenn Deason, you could give us some comments about inflation. I mean, have they really been able to do anything about that?
Well, let me just first comment on the World Bank and general reforms of these international institutions. The reluctance to carry out proper reforms. You can only do this for so long until these institutions are seen as no longer fit for purpose. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen over the past few years an alternative geoeconomic infrastructure emerging. So, for example, with the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which came up in 2015, this is very explicitly an initiative by the Chinese because the existing economic institutions were not reformed. So I think that's why I mentioned that we're transitioning now between unipolarity and multipolarity. The United States could facilitate these multipolar realities which are emerging, in which we would have these common institutions reformed to accommodate these new powers. However, it will not share power. And what you then see is new institutions being created without the U.S., often to some extent against the United States. So this is a key problem. Otherwise, regarding the debt, I think, and inflation, I think this is why the U.S., but also the Europeans, are very deep, in deep trouble by themselves, because we've been kicking the can, as mentioned, down the road for so long now. And for the United States, the problem is especially dangerous because at the moment the debt is so high and their currency now can't sustain this. So they're under pressure to increase the interest rates to defend the currency. However, if you increase the interest rates, then it's going to be impossible to service the debt. So you have all of these problems now, which you can't really get away from, because if they would increase the interest the extent to which is necessary, again, the economy would tank. If they don't, the currency will tank. And making matters worse is, as the U.S. is in relative decline, it will increasingly weaponize its economic system. So we see this through these very aggressive sanctions against more and more countries. And this is why the rest of the world, not just seeing this U.S. dollar being very weak now, or inflated, and also weaponized, which means they are now desperately looking for alternatives. And when those alternatives are found, that will only exacerbate the problem in the United States, because there's a lot of dollars they exported around the world, which have propped up their standard of living. And if those dollars begin to be sent back home, as the world no longer needs them, the United States will have a huge problem. So I don't see any on the horizon any generosity from the United States in terms of writing off other countries' debts, as they are now sinking very deep into this financial crisis, which is coming.
Well, we have to talk about another issue that was highlighted, so we can get that out of the way. And that's, and generally speaking, it's about climate change there, Harley Schlanger. You know, it kind of goes along the lines of what happened at the Paris agreements and other climate summits, perhaps, where you get agreements, but you get no agreements when it comes to action. I mean, who are they trying to fool? Are they fooling themselves? What is the deal there? Why is it that they always come out with commitments that are not being met? In this case, it's just a matter of geography with a venue called the G20.
Well, we saw what happened when the African leaders met with France's President Macron, and Macron proposes $1 trillion climate tax. And the African countries said, that's not going to work. Why should we pay a tax that will cause us to not develop? The African countries, you know, there are many countries in Africa. I think there are something like 16 countries where less than 20% of the population has access to electricity. And they're being told that they're not going to get electricity because we can't afford it because of the climate. So they see this as hypocrisy. And instead, they're talking to the Chinese, the Russians, they're talking to the Saudis and others about using their own fossil fuels, about developing nuclear power. India's economy depends on coal and fossil fuels. The same thing with China. Now, if you look at the other side of it, one of the countries that is trying to adhere to the Paris climate talks is Germany. And as a result, between the green policy in Germany and the sanctions against Russia and the blowing up of the Nord Stream pipeline, Germany is in a situation where its economy is tanking very quickly. Deindustrialization. People can't afford electricity here. Companies are leaving. Factories are shutting down. So the whole climate agenda is being used to increase the stranglehold of the most advanced countries over the rest of the world. And again, that's a non-starter.
All right. I wish we had more time. Unfortunately, we're out of time. But thank you so much for that, Harley Schlanger, spokesman of the International Schiller Institute. Glenn Deason, thank you. Professor of Political Science at the University of Southeastern Norway from Oslo. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vatahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.